Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's conversation with tennis legend Billie Jean King, whose story is dramatized in the new movie, Battle of the Sexes. King then takes a few more questions backstage at Studio AG exclusively for this podcast. But first, let's hear a closer look.
Republicans are once again making a mad dash to rush through a bill that would repeal Obamacare and drastically overhaul health care in this country. And once again, very few Republicans can actually defend their bill or explain what it does. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. There's nothing Donald Trump is better at than making big, empty promises, even though he has no idea how to achieve them. The latest example of this strategy came yesterday when Trump met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at the United Nations and said he'd like to achieve Middle East peace, although he seemed to have no real clue how to do it, as you can tell from his nonchalant tone.
Israel is working very hard toward the same goal, and I must tell you, Saudi Arabia and many of the different nations are working also hard. So we'll see if we can put it together. Who knows? Stranger things have happened.
He talks about Middle East peace the way people talk about getting back together with their ex. Hey, stranger things have happened, right? But he's right. Not only have stranger things happened, stranger things are constantly happening. I think we might all be trapped in an episode of Stranger Things. We're a week away from Trump saying, we're gonna pass healthcare, achieve Middle East peace, and bring Barb back from the upside down. We can get it done. Even when it comes to basic details, Trump is, of course, often confused. Just take his address yesterday at a luncheon with African leaders where he tried to praise several African countries for their efforts on healthcare, but seemed to make up a country on the spot.
In Guinea and Nigeria, you fought a horrifying Ebola outbreak. Namibia's health system is increasingly self-sufficient.
Of course, the problem is Namibia is not a country that actually exists. I'm pretty sure Trump pulled that right out of his Djibouti. Trump is single-handedly keeping Google's Did You Mean feature in business. That's right, Trump thinks there's a country called Namibia, which, of course, is right next to Nigeria, Stan. And can you believe this guy? Now, the who knows approach is basically the same approach Trump has used on healthcare. During the campaign, he claimed repeatedly that he would provide great health care at a much lower cost that would cover everybody and that it would be very easy to pass. Well, shockingly, it turns out Trump had no idea how to accomplish any of that. In fact, during a recent meeting where a bipartisan group of lawmakers tried to pitch him on a compromise bill to shore up Obamacare, all Trump cared about was the name. According to Politico, upon hearing it had bipartisan support, the president had one question: can I call it repeal and replace? A Democratic lawmaker responded, you can call it whatever you want, Mr. President. Hell, you can call it Namibia. No one else is using it. Now, Democrats and Republicans actually were getting close to a bipartisan solution that would have fixed some of the problems with Obamacare while keeping the bill largely in place. But GOP leaders decided to blow all of that up in favor of yet again another last-ditch effort to repeal and replace Obamacare.
A health care Hail Mary. The president pushing Republicans to not let this Obamacare repeal fail.
This is the Graham Cassidy bill. This really, for all intents and purposes, the final Hail Mary here for Republicans on health care.
Republicans pushing ahead with a Hail Mary plan, this Hail Mary option.
They're referring to it as a Hail Mary, essentially.
There's the last ditch, furious Hail Mary effort.
Of course, if this thing passes, a Hail Mary might be the only health care option some people can afford. Hail Mary, full of grace. Does this mole look weird to you? But that's right. They're throwing another Hail Mary, except Republicans aren't exactly Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers. They're more like Jay Cutler.
He's going to launch it. And that would be way out of bounds and complete.
Now, the main sponsors of this new bill are Senators Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham, and they are trying to rush it through for a vote as early as next week. Now, as you may recall, Republicans complained repeatedly about the process Democrats used to pass Obamacare in 2009 and 2010, even though it was a far more open process than they're using now. But they didn't just complain about the process. They even complained about the length of the bill itself. In fact, back in 2009, Senator Mitch McConnell thought the page length of the Obamacare bill was so damning that during one floor speech, he kept repeating it over and over.
We've now had less than 48 hours to look through this 2,074-page bill, this massive 2,074-page bill, buried in this 2,074-page bill, this monstrous 2,074-page bill on what is buried in this 2,074-page bill, in this 2,074-page bill, were we to pass this 2,074-page bill, this 2,074-page bill. What else do we know about this 2,074-page bill?
Well, there's one thing we definitely know. But here's the thing, it's supposed to be long. This isn't book club. You're reorganizing one-sixth of the American economy. Details are good. Just take Obamacare's protections for people with pre-existing conditions as an example. Obamacare had lots of very specific legal definitions for what kinds of coverage people with pre-existing conditions should get. The Affordable Care Act includes definitions in law of what's reasonable for an individual to spend on premiums given his or her income. By comparison, the new GOP bill has none of those details. That doesn't exist in Cassidy Graham. There aren't definitions of key terms like adequate or affordable. And I don't know if you've met the guy who will be signing this bill, but I'm not sure we should go by his definition of affordable. So the bill takes money away from vulnerable people on Medicaid and strips away protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Now, you might think, how could any senator vote for such a monstrous bill? Well, the answer is they either don't know or don't care. The website Vox interviewed GOP senators and asked them basic questions about the bill, and their answers were baffling. Take, for example, this exchange with Kansas Senator Pat Roberts, a reporter. Why does this make things better? What is this doing? Roberts, look, we're in the backseat of a convertible being driven by Thelma and Louise, and we're headed toward the canyon. That's a movie that you've probably never seen. Reporter, I do know Thelma and Louise, sir. Roberts, so we have to get out of the car, and you have to have a car to get into, and this is the only car there is. I love how he realized halfway through that his analogy made no sense, and he just hoped the reporter had never seen the movie. You see, it's kind of like Forrest Gump. You probably haven't seen that movie. No, I've seen it. Oh, it's like Minions. And on top of everything else this bill would do, it would also radically restructure and deeply cut Medicaid and would reduce total federal funding to states by $489 billion through 2027. Now, those cuts may seem savage and cruel, but to be fair, Republicans have always preached fiscal responsibility and the importance of saving money, and I'm sure this next series of clips about Trump's health secretary, Tom Price, won't prove that they're all full of
Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price is taking a little bit of heat after Politico found he took five private flights last week for events in Maine, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania. The cost? Tens of thousands of dollars.
That included a flight from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia and back on a 30-seat private charter at a cost of, and this is really astounding, $25,000.
$25,000. Do you know how short a flight is from D.C. to Philadelphia? If you tried to watch Thelma and Louise on that flight, you wouldn't meet Louise. Susan Sarandon is in it? Not the part I saw. So Tom Price thinks Medicaid patients should lose their health care but has no problem spending tens of thousands of dollars on private jets. And he's not the only one. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin also came under fire after he requested use of a government jet to take him and his wife on their European honeymoon. And before that, took a government aircraft to Kentucky on a trip that involved viewing the solar eclipse. And when he was asked about that taxpayer-funded eclipse trip, he tried to claim that he didn't actually care about the eclipse because he's from New York.
When I got there, the staff had actually intended that we watch the eclipse on the roof of Fort Knox. And, you know, people in Kentucky took this stuff very seriously. Being a New Yorker in California, I was like, the eclipse. So we got there, I was like, really? I don't have any interest in watching the eclipse.
You think New Yorkers don't care about the eclipse? I could show you one New Yorker who wanted to see the eclipse so badly, he almost burned his retinas.
Boy, I don't want the glasses. I want to see the whole thing. No glasses.
So these guys think millions of people should have their health care ripped away from them while they spend thousands on private jets and eclipse trips they don't even care about. And now the question is, can they get the votes to pass this bill? Republicans are pulling out all the stops, even forming unlikely alliances. Lindsey Graham, for example, said he's even been in contact with his one-time nemesis, Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, and that Bannon has been helping him push the new repeal bill. Graham said of Bannon, "Me and Darth Vader are now talking to each other." Hey, Lindsey, when you're trying to get a bill passed, you're not supposed to admit that the people you're working with are evil. Let's just say Cruella De Vil and I have been working on something that I believe will be good for all Dalmatians. But there are still some holdouts. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul remains opposed to the bill because he thinks it doesn't actually go far enough in repealing Obamacare. So, to win over votes, Trump has been tweeting. Yesterday, he claimed, "I would not sign Graham Cassidy if it did not include coverage of pre-existing conditions." It does. A great bill, repeal and replace. And before that, he tweeted, "Rand Paul is a friend of mine, but he is such a negative force when it comes to fixing health care. Graham Cassidy bill is great, ends Obamacare." So Trump managed to claim three falsehoods in there. Bill covers pre-existing conditions. It doesn't. Graham Cassidy bill is great. It's not. And Rand Paul is a friend of mine. He is?
His visceral response to attack people on their appearance, short, tall, fat, ugly. My goodness, that happened in junior high. Are we not way above that? Would we not all be worried to have someone like that in charge of the nuclear arsenal?
Mr. Trump.
I never attacked him on his look, and believe me, there's plenty of subject matter right there. That I can tell you.
But Jake, plenty of subject matter right there. Trump knows more about Rand Paul's appearance than he knows about his own health care bill. In fact, his Rand Paul burn book is 2,074 pages. So Republicans are racing to jam through a health care bill that would destroy Medicaid and strip coverage from millions of people, including those with pre-existing conditions. Could Republicans really be shameless enough to pass this monstrous bill?
Who knows? Stranger things have happened.
This has been A Closer Look.
Ryan Reese, audience warm comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers, here with Mike from Detroit. Michigan's a swing state. How do you feel about the upcoming election in 2020? What are issues that are important to you?
Important to me are progressive issues, environment, obviously Michigan having the fresh water supply, that's important. We keep putting oil pipelines through all our fresh water supply, like the Ugala Aquifer. It's really a disaster. So environment is important, Medicare for all, and then college for everybody. I don't see why we can't do college for everyone. If we can fight any war whenever we want to, if we can bomb five countries at one time, but we can't send some kids to college, I don't understand it.
A special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, has requested White House documents regarding some of the president's decisions. What do you think of the Mueller investigation?
I think the Mueller investigation is fantastic because, the president's lawyers are getting lawyers. Obviously, Russia had a big hand in it.
Do you think the Russians had a hand in the 2016 election?
Yeah, we already know they did. We know Facebook has already released the information that they were buying, tons of ads. So let's see what happens with the a dossier that came out, see if there's a P-tape.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
With 39 Grand Slam titles, our guest is one of the greatest tennis players of all time. Her iconic match against Bobby Riggs 44 years ago today is the subject of the film Battle of the Sexes, which is in select theaters Friday and everywhere September 29th. Please welcome to the show, Billie Jean King, everybody. Welcome to the show.
I see Fred over there. Boom.
Fred was very excited you were here tonight.
I'm excited. He's in the movie, Battle of the Sexes.
There you go. And this is very exciting. We can tell from the clip. Emma Stone plays you in the film. Here's a shot of you guys. We're actually watching tennis together.
I know. Scary, isn't it?
Well, I wanted to ask, are you, because of your history and because of you being this legendary tennis, are you fun to watch tennis with?
Terrible.
Really? Why are you bad?
Terrible. Because I kind of commentate. You know, I don't have any filter. So I, like, commentate the whole time and running. And I said to Emma, there's an empty seat over here. Let me go over there and sit so you don't have to listen to me. And she goes, oh, no, I want you right here. I want you to talk to me right in my ear because I don't know them that much, and I want you to sit right here. Poor thing. Afterwards, I think she went, oh, I should have let her sit over there.
Now, one of the things you believe about tennis is, being a tennis player, is it's not just sort of the athletic skill, the technical skill, that one of the things you have to do is be an entertainer.
That's what we are.
Yeah.
You know that tennis court? That's our stage. Just like in theater or what you're doing here, this is your stage. No, I always thought of it as our stage. And our job is, it's about the audience. If you give a speech or what you do, it's about you guys. It's about the audience. My job is to connect with them. And so when they just go home at night, they go, God, that was unbelievable. They connected. They want to go back. Let's go back and watch.
And so you were thinking about that on the court. That's fantastic.
When I was young. Oh, yeah, I love it. I love movies, love theater, love dance. I love everything.
And were there to, could you feel when you had the audience in the palm of your hand while you were out on the court?
I never felt like I ever had a palm on him, but I felt like we were connecting.
Connecting's good.
You know, like sitting next to him going, can you believe this? This is unbelievable.
And when you decided to do this match against Bobby Riggs, what were you setting out to accomplish? Because I think as soon as you took it on, a lot of people put a lot of things on you as far as what they thought you were trying to accomplish. What was your main thrust of your plan there?
Well, it's all about social change, trying to fight for equality and freedom for everyone. Thank you. They didn't hold up applause, did they?
No, we don't even have one of those.
I'm kidding. No, because I understood it was about social change. Because when I was 12, I had an epiphany. And I'd played tennis 1 year, and I wanted to be number one when I was 11. But at 12, I was daydreaming at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. And I noticed everybody who played had white shoes, white socks, white clothes, played with white balls. And everybody who played was white. And I asked the question, where is everybody else? And that was my moment of truth for my life. And, I just knew it.
And do you feel good about where tennis is in the sport right now when you look out, when you watch the U.S. Open this year?
Yeah, it's not the right question to ask me.
Okay.
You know why?
Why?
I'm such a pain.
Oh, yeah?
I'm a total pain in the backside, and I totally am a perfectionist, so it's always can be better.
Okay, well, that's good. I think that that's a good way to look at everything right now,
is
that it can be better.
Yeah,
we can't be satisfied.
You think?
I think so. I think we agree on that.
So,
I want to ask about this as well. President Obama, he named you as one of the two openly gay delegates to go to the Sochi Olympics, and then he gave you a Medal of Freedom. What was it like to meet President Obama?
It was amazing. Receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom, first of all, it's the first time a president's ever mentioned the LGBTQ community and sexual preference, and I really had an honor to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom with also Harvey Milk posthumously. Mm-hmm. His nephew received it. He was there. So that was the first ever. Also, I was the first woman athlete to receive it, which was good news, bad news, because there's so many women that came before me that deserve it, like Althea Gibson, Babe Diedrichsen. There's so many that deserve it. So many male athletes have been honored. So I really hope that shifts. But to be just, I love, he just understood, he understands me, and he saw the match, the Battle of the Sexes when he was 12. And when I first met him, when we went into the Oval Office, I'm like this, you know how they have the two chairs everybody sits in so they get all the photos? Oh, no. I went over and I sit like this on the sofa. He's looking at me like, what are you over there for? And I'm like, so we never had a photo, and I knew he put it in the back of my mind. So as soon as we got up to leave, he goes, let's have a photo. You know, the guy, the photographer's there constantly. But I just felt so, I don't know, I was just kind of overwhelmed with the whole occasion. But he said, I saw the match when I was 12, and now that I have two daughters, it changed my life. And I get these stories from the men all the time now that they have daughters. And sometimes they don't have to have daughters. It changed how their perception of how they're going to look at women, how they're going to treat women, have more respect. But women come up to me, and they just gained so much confidence, and they felt so empowered, and they asked for a raise the next day. They'd been waiting 10 years to have the guts to ask, because girls are taught not to ask for what we want and need. Can't do that. So it was like, and I said, more importantly, did you get the raise?
Yeah.
And you know what? Every single one of them told me yes.
Oh, well, that's fantastic.
It's amazing.
Well, thank you for everything you've done. No. Thank you for everything you continue to do.
Thank you.
What an honor to have you here tonight. Thanks. Billie Jean King, everybody. Battle of the Sexes in Select Theater, Saturday, September 29th.
Everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with tennis legend icon Billie Jean King, the subject of the really great new movie, Battle of the Sexes. We were just chatting, and you were telling me about this great song that Sarah Bareilles created for the movie.
Yes, and also Nick Patel.
Okay.
He actually did all the music for the movie, and then they co-wrote it. And then, of course, Sarah sings it. But you'll hear the piano and the keys from Nick. And you'll hear a little bit of the theme of the movie. And it's really amazing how they intertwine both. And then also his wife, Nick's wife, Caitlin, is a cellist on the music. But Sarah, she did it again. She's amazing with lyrics. She has a wonderful following. And it's absolutely uplifting, and she named it If I Dare. It's a great title, and I hope people, and particularly young people, will listen to the lyrics, and maybe it'll help somebody.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the movie in terms of the actual Battle of the Sexes match. You obviously played in the match. Watching the movie, did you get tense while you were watching the match, even though you knew
who won? Oh, I'm a mess.
Won?
Oh, yeah.
You're
totally
a mess.
I have a hard time watching the movie because it brings back so much joy and pain. And even though I know the outcome of all these things, I'm like, I can't breathe. I catch myself that I've been holding my breath. Mm-hmm. And then I exhale and start over breathing. I go, Billy, breathe. Jeez, it's so tense.
Yeah. So you and Seth were just talking about your experience with President Obama.
Yes.
Can you tell this incredible story of what he told you about how he actually learned about you and watched you way before Battle of the Sexes?
Yeah, because my former husband, Larry, and I, and Larry's played by Austin Stoll in the Battle of the Sexes, and he did an amazing job. Larry's a lawyer in Hawaii with Case & Case. It was the biggest law firm. And that Steve Cases, you know, AOL.
Created, oh, yeah.
It's his daddy.
Wow.
Okay, so I used to play table tennis with Steve.
Wow!
Yeah, and his brothers and his family. I think one brother. So I would practice at Punahou. There's only one guy I could play with in all of the islands of Hawaii that was good enough to play against for practice. It was Rick Reed, who's number one in the world, in like 75 and over now, and he's a lawyer. So he only got lunch off, and he's a lefty. So we'd always go over to Punahou, which is close to his office, and practice. And it was always a couple times there's two little kids in the back watching, one a white child and a child of color. Well, lo and behold, that was President Obama.
That is amazing.
And I said, why didn't you ask me to hit with you? And he says, you would have? I said, in a heartbeat, because I love kids. But I was so, I only got this hour of practice. I mean, it was terrible to live there for me personally with my career. But so I was back and forth a lot, and it's far.
Yeah.
But it just shows you how, you never know how a person's going to touch your life or how you're going to touch their life.
Right.
Here I'm sitting in the Oval Office of the White House many years later, and here's President Obama, this little kid.
Can you talk about what you tell athletes about the social change they can create? Because I know that's something you really believe in pretty strongly.
I try to make them understand that we have this unbelievable platform because tennis is global. Mm-hmm. So if they get good enough to be playing on the WTA Tour, if you're a woman, or an ATP Tour as a man, that you have an unbelievable opportunity. And I hope you think of it even a little bit as an obligation to go back to your village, your town, your country. I mean, we have players from all over the world. We have over 2,000 rankings in women's and men's tennis. I mean, we have people playing all over the world. So you have an opportunity with this platform to have this exposure that very few people ever have in their lifetime to do good with it. So I'm always trying to encourage them to go back and do whatever you're interested in. Maybe start a charity. Do something with your life besides just hit tennis balls and win tennis matches, because someday you're not going to be able to do this either. Mm-hmm. So try to think about, envision yourself doing well, but doing good.
Yeah.
And do good for others. So all I can do is try to influence, and you never know. You know, some of the players have really stepped up and done so many great things.
Right. So the movie covers and shows kind of the blatant and overt sexism that you face, other female players faced.
But we still face it every day.
So this is what I wanted to ask. What are the sexist ways people talk about athletes today that maybe aren't as overt or blatant as they were back
they
in
just
the
70s? They're much smarter now. The Old Boy Network, they don't talk about it anymore. Hmm. They actually just leave us out. But I can tell when they're going to leave us out.
Yeah.
No, we know. I mean, women aren't stupid. But women aren't socialized properly either. Like, we're told, don't ask for what you want and need, which I mentioned on the show with Seth tonight. And then also, we're always saying, I'm sorry. I mean, if you see two doubles players or basketball team or anything that are girls, we're always saying, I'm sorry. Well, where did we pick that up? The guys don't. Just get on with it. And you know, girls are taught to be perfect. We're always taught and told to be perfect, look perfect, be perfect, other thing. No one's perfect. And boys are always taught to be brave. Well, boys can't be brave all the time. So neither is correct. But when you're taught that you're supposed to be perfect when you're young and you get that message, look at all the commercials about our bodies and our images. It's always about how do we look. It's never about our inner success counts. We know. We understand. And that happens every day to us as we go through the day. Little things all the time. It's constant. And that adds up over time. But we need to socialize our men and our boys really in a positive way, and our girls, mm-hmm. so we respect each other. I think the millennials and the Gen Z are the best generations ever in the history of this world that really are into inclusiveness and do care about each other. And they're the best ever.
You're optimistic.
I'm very optimistic. I mean, I've got godchildren now. They're in their 20s, and they're unbelievable guys. Mm-hmm. And they're very respectful. And they obviously, you got to respect yourself, too. Right. Girls don't respect themselves enough a lot because we're always told we're not good enough because we're not going to be perfect. We're not going to be perfect, folks. And neither are boys. But we're never going to, none of us, we're not going to be brave either. Everyone's not going to be brave mm-hmm. all the time either. It's impossible. We all have these insecurities. We all have disappointments. We all go through life. You know, we all grow up in dysfunctional families. We got to just kind of help each other through this.
Right. Last question I want to ask you. We were talking about your relationship with President Obama. Can you tell us about your relationship with Elton John and the song you helped inspire? This is an incredible story.
Well, it goes back to the King Riggs match. Jerry Parenteau, who was promoting the match, it's 2 weeks before the match. We're in L.A., and he asked me to come to this party. And because it's Jerry and relationships are everything, I did it for Jerry. So I walk in, I go, Jerry, is this party for you? What is this party about? He goes, oh, no, it's Elton John. I went, oh, he's my favorite. Because back in 71, I had pulled over to the curb when I heard your song for the first time. And piano was always my first love, but I'm not any good at it. So God gave me and my brother extra coordination and fire, or whether our DNA's right about being great champions in sports. But so I said, well, he's my favorite. So we sat that whole night. Elton kept looking at me. I kept looking at him. Finally, Tony King, his manager, comes over. He says, this is ridiculous. Elton has been dying to meet you all night. He keeps looking at you, and he's just too shy. And I went, ditto. I remember saying ditto.
Yeah.
That's all I said. He goes, that's ridiculous. Get up. Come with me. I want you to. So I walked over with Tony. He says, sits me down. He goes, Elton, this is Billy. Billy, this is Elton. And you guys start talking. Don't waste any more time. And we just hit it off like that. And then when I went to Wimbledon 6 months later, he left a message, please call. I almost didn't call him because I'm too shy.
Really?
I finally got up the courage. I called him. He says, what are you doing? I said, I just got in. He says, well, can I come over? So he came over in his Rolls Royce with 28 speakers, and we played. So fast forward to 1974. I'm playing my first year of world team tennis for the Philadelphia team, the Philadelphia Freedoms. I chose the name. We're in a car going to one of his concerts. He says, I want to write a song for you. I said, what? And he says, I want to write a song. He says, what are we going to call it? What are we going to call it? Because he thinks very fast. You got to be fast to keep up with him. And I go, I don't know. I'm just trying to get over the fact you're going to write a song for me. Are you serious? Sure. He says, I'm really serious. He says, why don't we call it Philadelphia Freedom? I said, that would be a great gift to the people of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It's become the anthem. People love it. And also he says, it'll be great. Then you'll have a signature song for the team as well. He says, but this song's for you. And that's it. And they sent me a little 45 in those days, vinyl.
Uh-huh.
It said dedicated to BJK.
Wow.
So he's a dear friend. Ilana and I have been, my partner and I have been on his board of the Elton John AIDS Foundation since 1992 when he first, we've done fundraisers for 24 years to raise money for the foundation. He's given almost $400 million.
Wow.
A lot of it is his own money. to help AIDS and help the people with HIV/AIDS that no one cares about. They're incarcerated. They don't care. We used to visit people. It's amazing. Tennis was one of the first ones to get behind it because of Arthur Ashe died of AIDS.
Oh, yeah.
So we were much more open about it, had much more knowledge. So Ilana and I have had this privilege of being connected to the Elton John AIDS Foundation forever and ever. And he loves team tennis. He loves team tennis. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just meant to be friends. And
that's fantastic.
He took me out on stage. He carried me out, literally.
Is that right?
Yeah, at the Spectrum in Philadelphia when it was... The Spectrum's been imploded since, but... And I became a backup vocalist for probably at least 30 concerts. And,
really?
Yeah.
You good?
I'm terrible. I told the engineer, I always would yell down to the guy, I go, turn my mic off, because I can lift...
Did Elton know?
He didn't care. He wants me up there. He wants me up there, and then he wants the choreographing, doing the can-can kick,
sure.
and the VBs, the other great, the good ones, the backup, the ones that were really there and legit, mm-hmm. were so good to me. They're just so sweet to me. I said, sing in my ear, because in Glee Club, I love singing, but I said, in Glee Club, if I had a really strong person next to me that helped me stay in tune, but not great. But I know it. At least I know it. And if I know I'm off, I just shut up.
Sure.
Yeah, just shut up, because I can't get it. I can't sing a cappella. So, but it was really a great experience. Yeah. And we see each other all the time.
That's
usually
fantastic.
Stay with him when we go to Wimbledon. We'll stay in a few days and just catch up. And now we got the two boys,
yeah.
With Zach and Elijah. They're mm-hmm. so cute.
Yeah.
And David, get to see David, his husband. And,
yeah.
No, we're really close to them. I love them very much.
That's fantastic. Billy, I cannot thank you enough for your time, for being on the show. Such an inspiration. It was such a pleasure
it's
chatting with
you. It's great to see
you.
Thank you so much. It's been so much fun.
It's been truly our treat. Thank you again.
And the crowd tonight was great, by the way.
Really great crowd. They were very excited to see you. Our staff was very, very excited you were on the show
tonight. I was excited to meet everybody, and thank you for your hospitality.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Once upon a beat!
Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new kids and family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.